As we look across the range of small businesses, some of them want to achieve a certain size and stay there. Others are desperate for growth, and neither is the right answer.
You've got startups that are technically small businesses, whether that's in tech, whether it's products, services, in a mature market, and then some people are entering emerging markets. So it's really complicated.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Marketing Podcast, episode number 49. I am Shaheen Khan, sitting here with Doug Garnett and a very special guest who we had the opportunity to connect with back in episode number 38, Mr. Sam Brealey, who has kindly made time available all the way from Northern England to talk with us. How are you, Sam? How are you, Doug?
Good, thank you.
And welcome to the episode that's the square of seven. It's a good number.
That's an excellent point. How are you, Sam? It's been a while since we connected.
Yes, it has been a while. Can't remember all of the details of the last podcast. I definitely enjoyed it. And I've been going through lots of professional changes and trying out jobs and not enjoying them and then going back into freelancing and just figuring out what makes me happy and fulfilled, but then striking the balance with paying bills, which is the bottom line for the individual. So yeah.
That's the life of a marketing professional for many. Now, we had a bunch of requests after our last episode together that folks wanted more on small business because you have specialized in that world and you have some excellent case studies and clients that you work with. And a lot of us work with small businesses. They're a different bunch, and it would be nice to double click on that. So we are delighted to have that opportunity. Doug, you want to chime in on what you heard from your listeners?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that happens with focusing on small business that brings a lot of things together. In the pre-show, I know that even when I was in very large businesses, a lot of the efforts I worked on felt like small business efforts. You felt weak, like you didn't have enough resources. And, you know, all the stuff that I later encountered as a small business owner come around. So I think there's a lot that marketers and businesses have to learn from small business, but they tend to get ignored because it's a lot easier to write about public companies because the data's there, the information's there, they're famous, investors are fascinated by them. And yet in the U.S., 99% of companies are not public. So, I mean, and that includes companies like a Trek Bicycle, which is very large, but not public. And, you know, challenges like that don't get well reported on. So I think it's a really important topic.
So let's characterize this. When we're working with a small business, what are the issues that we need to know upfront going in? Obviously, they're small. So right there, that's the first domino. What does that mean?
The biggest challenge with a small business is defining small because, as Doug says, it's the same in the UK. 99% of businesses are SMEs, as we call them, or SMBs, as they're called stateside. And in the UK, that's defined as any business with a turnover of less than £10 million or less than 50 employees. So actually, when you think about it, that is not what many people would think is a small business. A lot of people think small business is 10 people, you know, turnover of sub-£1 million, which is a lot of businesses. But ultimately, the definition of a small business is actually, to most people, still reasonably large. Like, you know, you've got regional employers that are well-known with history behind them that are still technically small businesses. You've got startups that are technically small businesses, whether that's in tech, whether it's products, services, whether it's in a mature market, you know, people do still make small businesses and enter into mature markets. And then some people are entering emerging markets. So it's really complicated. Whilst I feel like for bigger businesses, it's clearer cut. There are certain competitors that are very similar. They operate in similar market conditions. They have similar headcounts. I mean, they share employees, let's be honest. Like, often people move around those big businesses. So there's also a degree of shared culture. Whilst with smaller businesses, you don't get that. But what you do get in smaller businesses is an attempt to mimic the successes of large businesses. And that is the, in my opinion, biggest issue that small businesses have. They try to be something they are not. Or in a more positive way to frame that, they try to be something they are not yet.
Doug, what do you see when you work with small businesses?
First, I confirm Sam's observation that there's a far wider variety of small businesses than there are in large companies. Yeah, you see some things that I think we confuse small business with startup a lot of times, or small business with what we might call entrepreneur, somebody really focused on some ambition to do something big, but they have to start small to get there. Because if I look around, I look around my daily life and there's all these small businesses I circulate around where having one storefront is what they want and they make profit that way and they support their life and they're very happy. So as we look across the range of small businesses, some of them want to achieve a certain size and stay there. Others are desperate for growth and neither is the right answer. It all depends on the people that own them and what's going on. I do think that access to capital and investment is one of the key challenges everywhere in small business, that every small business seems to struggle with that question of what can I afford and how can I afford it. And if they don't have access to venture capital, then it's banks. And banks are well known for enjoying loaning money to people who already have it.
I tell you what I see, besides limited resources, because, even if your turnover is 10 million pounds, what fraction of revenue are you going to allocate to marketing, right? Probably not a lot. So then what can you really do? Let's say for the sake of argument, you allocated 3%. And I think many don't even do that. So now you have like 300K pounds. And well, they have to pay you with it. And then you have to go shopping and you have to do some things. And, so basically to me, if you're not a big company, you really can't have permanent staff. And if you do have permanent staff, they're not going to be very highly paid.
Like permanent marketing.
Based on numbers. Yeah, marketing staff. Right. So that's one thing that I see. The second thing I see is that they don't necessarily understand the importance of marketing or the way marketing works. I use, Doug, your gumball machine analogy, and you should explain to folks how you formulate that. But that is a reality that they don't seem to accept, and there are too many marketing agencies who let them believe that's the case.
We like to think of marketing as a really simple lever pull. So you put a quarter into the gumball machine, and you know what you're going to get out. And we want to think that marketing always works that way, but marketing is much more where you put a quarter in the machine, and you may not really know what's going to come out. Sometimes it won't put anything back. Sometimes you'll get three gumballs. You like those three gumball times. But it's really tough. Marketing is not like the other things in business where you can have a fairly reliable expectation of if I do this, that will happen. A lot of times marketing, you have to do things where you really can't measure what might happen. You have to do them based on a trust that you're doing the right thing and making progress. And, there's no gumball that comes out in that case, but spending the money may have been exactly the right thing to do. You just don't have any conclusive, absolute proof showing it. And it's a different world for people in business because a lot of people want to enter business and are told to expect that everything's measurable, everything's rational, everything is clear. And, right. It isn't. I was going to say, coming back too, I wanted to, come back in with one more factor in small businesses, which is I think in small business, we tend to become obsessed with our weaknesses. It's really easy to focus on what we don't have that the big guys have or, those things. And yet we know the truth of business success is that you succeed based on what you offer that's unique and different and to some degree.
What do you mean? What is motivating you to say that?
Well, Sam noted in his discussion the desire to copy, big businesses. Mm-hmm. So, and I remember a lot of discussions in the company you and I were with Shaheen about, these guys sell 1 million units a year. If we could just get 1% of that, we'll be happy. And our VP saying, guys, it doesn't work that way. You're not going to get 1% by copying them. And so, what you have to do is figure out why people care about you specifically. What is that unique thing you bring? I don't know, Sam, if you have more thoughts to expand on that uniqueness.
I think part of the issue with this is it's almost unlearning what you've learned. So when you're a kid and you're at school, you are told that there are answers and they're correct answers and there are wrong answers. But in adult life, you very quickly start to learn, in your personal life especially, that you can still do everything right and stuff can still go wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens with businesses is they struggle to accept that reality and they want to simplify stuff. They want stuff to be a pattern, essentially, because that's what makes humans. We're good at pattern recognition and all of those mm-hmm. kinds of things. And actually, it's intellectually lazy. And I don't mean that as an insult. It's just that is how we're wired. We're looking mm-hmm. for that. We're looking to simplify rather than recognizing complexity and rather than recognizing that we don't know things. And to the aforementioned point of weaknesses, at school, you're told, oh, well, if you're not good at maths, then you really need to get better at maths. You know, you're told that you need to do that. And it's the same when you go into jobs. You know, it's you got to be good at everything, but actually you end up just being average at everything if that's the approach, because you never get the opportunity to be really good at a couple of things. If you're lucky, you might meet a boss who has that line of thinking and recognizes that they can encourage you to go down a route that you're really good at. So, and I think that's the biggest issue, which is that people will go, well, weakness is a bad thing, so we need to fix that, rather than going, well, hang on, let's ignore the weaknesses. Let's look at what we're good at and really focus on building on that. And not just in business in general, but also, you know, people are part of the business. You know, if you want to succeed, bring out the strengths in your people and the business will probably be in a far better position to succeed because you're not messing around with perceived weaknesses or making comparisons with others. You know, people say that, you know, what is the exact quote, that comparison is the thief of joy. You know, it's the same with customers. Comparison is the thief of customers. Don't compare yourself to everyone else because you're not everyone else.
It's interesting with that is there's also an implication there that I think is important in small business, which is you will not be what everybody wants. And that can be hard to accept because I think a lot of large business practices are based on the idea that we want everybody to buy our product or we want to be, you know, large companies have enough profit to be able to try to be everything to everybody, even though they can't be either. It's a truth about any company. But I think in small business, it's, you know, it's like there's this confidence you need to trust that being what you are strong at is a good thing. And that could be a really tough trust to build.
Yeah, agreed. And I think ultimately, I mean, with my clients, some of them have described me as a therapist. They've said more like a business therapist or a marketing therapist. And that's because I recognize that, you know, what motivates people to start businesses or work in small businesses is because they want to do it. You know, anyone could just go and try and go for a bigger business and kind of have the safety of that. But if you've taken the chance, not only is that a risk in terms of capital and everything else and the logical side of things, but it's an emotional risk as well. And it's hard on people. So I think it's really important to really understand that element of it, the people element. And that might sound wishy-washy, but actually from my experiences, you know, when I first started doing consulting work, I found that I didn't hit the mark when I was keeping it very quote unquote professional. You know, when we weren't talking about individual motivations and really delving deep into personal challenges, you know, we were heading down a kind of almost mechanical route of business, which I think is what people want it to be, because that's easier to understand. When in reality is that when it's a smaller business, that individual factor is so much more present, especially when it's an owner-managed business. You know, let's say you're the big boss and everything's on your shoulders. There isn't a board. There's no one else looking after you. It's just you. There's your 15 mm-hmm. members of staff and things aren't looking good. That's going to take its toll on you mentally and physically and everything else. So it's good to be aware of that and the impact that will have on the bottom line and everything else. It's all connected. It's just connected in very messy and complex ways.
Reminds me of the first cartoon we had, you know, set up here, that the cartoon has two carrots. One carrot is massive and sticking up above ground is a small little sprig of foliage. The other carrot is tiny and it has this huge rich carrot top sticking above the ground. And the comment that goes with it is success is not always what you see. And the reason it struck me about small business is I think that one of the struggles I always felt as a small business, because I both advised them and been one, was that we never had the money to spend to create the appearance of a rich foliage above ground. you know, to put out those things. In fact, one of our decisions was I kept my company offices on the east side of Portland, which is slightly funkier, less prestigious. And my competitors all had glorious offices on the west side. In the long run, what I found out is most of my clients appreciated that we cared more about the work than the foliage. You know, so in fact, we had, you know, substance underground, but just weren't, you know, we didn't pay as much to make the foliage look rich. But I think that's here with all that we're talking about that, you know, is difficult. I guess it leads me to wonder, what are those strengths that small businesses have in general in the market that we would tend to ignore? Are there any?
Well, what I'm observing, it may not be a strength as much as just the reality and how it exposes different parameters, is that in a small company, understanding how revenue is made just seems a lot more critical than it is in a big company where things have already been established and even forgotten and taken for granted, right? You know a bunch of revenue is coming at the end of the quarter, almost rain or shine, right? Unless it stops doing it and then you have a disaster. But generally, you have a flywheel going. And in a small company, it is incumbent on the marketing staff to understand how revenue is made. The number one, you know, complaint, if you will, that I imagine would be leveled by small business owners is that their marketing people aren't aligned with the business. These guys are good businessmen and women. They know how to extract money. They, you know, and that's kind of part of the challenge of marketing for them. I think the other one is the need for financial performance now rather than build a company of the future. You don't have that in a startup. A startup really is, in a way, sort of relieved from having to produce financial results anytime soon, which is why you see these big companies, you know, grow to be large sizes and they're still not profitable because they're still investing on some other objective out there and they can spend a lot of money trying to get there. Whereas a typical small company needs to show profitability now. And therefore, the resources are now. You said that earlier, it really depends on their strategy, and you're absolutely right. If they have a strategy for growth and they have the capital to invest in it, then that's a different, then they are building the company of the future. I think doing marketing for that kind of company is way easier than the ones that need to show profitability every month.
But in a way, it's just an interesting question, which is, I have found in my life tremendous value for knowing how profit develops. You know,
where does money come from?
There's a fundamental theme about, you know, I mean, when I started in computers, I worked on microcomputers and I was frustrated because I wanted to be on mainframes, you know, the big ones. And my boss said, you're going to know at the end of 6 months how a computer really works. And all these guys out here running the mainframe, they don't. None of them held a disk drive in their hand. And so, and I wonder to some degree if that's some of what happens in small business is that we have to be in touch with things and really know what creates that more so than large companies. And I don't know, Sam, if you have any thoughts that would, you know, dovetail or if that takes you in a direction.
Yes. So you're completely right. It's a question of follow the money. Is in terms of where does it actually come from. However, the practical reality, like Shaheen says, is that marketers in a lot of smaller businesses, they are effectively the carrot dressage. They are the leaves. That is the job they're given. They're told we need to work on the brand. Brand becomes synonymous with graphic design. They'll spend a lot of money on branding every couple of years and Facebook posts and PR and yada, yada, yada. And it's all just visual and auditory noise. But because it's visible, it's seen as politically okay. And also it's like, it's a lesser evil, you know, or necessary evil, I should say, which is we have to do it. So let's just let them do it rather than recognizing that the value of marketing is often in the really boring, mundane stuff, which would often sit and actually practically often sits in other departments or with other team members. And that's the thing I often stress to people, which is small businesses that are successful are doing good marketing. Whether they have structured it and they're aware of the fact that they're doing good marketing is a different question. And I've seen that before where people go, well, we don't have a marketing team. And then you ask what the salesperson does, or you ask what the, you know, managing director is doing. And then you just go, well, that's marketing. You just haven't called it that. And they go, no, marketing is that, is like Facebook ads. And you go, no, it's not. So there is definitely an issue with the perception of marketing in smaller businesses. And partly that is, that's the problem of both sides. It's both marketers not being qualified enough. You know, that unfortunately, I've got pretty strong opinions on this, which is marketers need to be more qualified. You know, I think it's not good enough to have senior marketers and it's like, well, you've got 10 years experience running events and maybe running Facebook ads, but that's it. You've not really shown yourself to be anything more than that. And that's, I think, a valid criticism. You know, you go out and get trained. Even if you have to pay for it yourself, do it. That's what I did. There's no excuses, not in this day and age. So go out and do it as an individual and it'll benefit you anyway in terms of career prospects and everything else. But, you know, in terms of as a business, rather than getting these full-time staff in and just saying, you know, that's their job, which is they just do the fluffy stuff, you know, be more creative and think differently, which is, you know, get in a freelancer who you can pay that £25,000 a year. And yes, he might only be, or he or she might be with you for 3 months, but you're going to get a lot more value because they're going to, you know, properly evaluate how your business actually makes money. And they'll put structures and processes in place that enable you to connect the dots internally to see how marketing is actually being done. Because it is being done. Like I say, it's just whether or not it's got a label attached to it or not. And I think you see that with any good entrepreneur, they're natural marketers in a lot of ways.
I want to just emphasize what you said, Sam, and we have talked about this on this podcast a few times, that marketing folks wanting a seat at the table should be qualified to have a seat at the table. You can't just want it. Mm-hmm. You have to be worth it. Mm-hmm. And that necessitates exactly what you said, Sam. You need to understand the business. You need to be able to contribute. And as you know, I wrote this whole big missive on how marketing is the hardest job in the company because it touches everything. Mm-hmm. You have to know about legal, about technology, about customer, about geography, about on and on. And you touch every other function in the company. It's a really tall order. It's an extremely difficult job. And then if you're not sort of feeling that, then you're probably not going to be incented to go learn all of that. But you have to be voracious. And if you do that, then it pays off. It absolutely does. Because then you're the most qualified person in that room. And you can add value in ways that is visible.
Is that part of the small business challenge, is that small businesses desperately need really seasoned, experienced, sophisticated marketing people, but my God, they're expensive. And you know, it leaves a quandary for small businesses that you really need people who are deeply experienced, but may not feel you can pay for that.
I think it's more that they don't think they can get it rather mm-hmm. than they don't want it. Mm-hmm. Right?
And well, I guess that's what I mean, that they can, you know, they don't feel like they can afford it. Or that they can
I think they feel like they don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They feel like I want this quality, this profile of a person, but everybody that I meet is either a high paid consultant who's not going to do anything from like the big whatever, or someone who's still learning the ropes themselves.
Or just a social media person.
Or someone who's kind of got a narrower scope.
Mm-hmm. And I've worked in agencies in the past. Some are good, some are bad, some have good intentions, but are still ultimately useless. You know, yes, they have successes, but it's more luck than anything. And it's because, you know, the agency model for in a lot of ways is ridiculous anyway. You've got these gray-haired managing directors that come in and they do the talk and make the connections and the rapport with the business owner, and it sounds really good, but then it's 24-year-old graduates that are executing and doing all the work, and you just think, this is weird. This is almost a scam because they're handing it off to kids. And the reason they're doing that is because they can't make money with the model anyway. So that's really common, which is they go, we need marketing support, we need marketing help, and then agencies come in. Like I say, whether or not the intention is good or bad, the result is often the same, which is they spend a lot of money and don't really get a lot for it. And sometimes it does work out, but it's more fluke than not. And I've had this in positions as well, where I've been doing the work that I should be doing rather than the work that I'm told to do. So, you know, using things like customer research and using those skills. And I mean, just to simplify this point, I guess, going back to the training thing is, for me, I'm a little more optimistic in that I don't believe it necessarily has to be super experienced marketers. I think it can just be someone who's actually trained. to be honest, I think if it's a graduate who's, you know, they've studied business and economics and marketing at university, they've got really good grades, they're actually trained, hire that person. Don't just hire the person who's got TikTok experience or the person who talks about ChatGPT, and don't mistake comms for marketing, because that's the main issue. So, you know, I would say, sounds really harsh, but the social media stuff, the TikTok stuff, that's the stuff that can be learned on the job. The rest of it is the qualification thing, in my
view. Well, that stuff is also easy, in a sense, easier to outsource than anything. You know, you just, the skill set's out there to buy. When I started my agency, we focused on creating the ads and developing the strategy for media, because I knew that media buyers, there's plenty of them out there, and there was no need for one more. So why build that myself? And it was great. And I think that's one of those, you know, kind of Occam's razors, I suppose, in marketing, is deciding where you draw those lines. What needs to be inside as our really unique things, and what goes outside, because it can be hired.
From a really simple kind of summary perspective of what that good marketing looks like for a small business, it's right, you've got a business plan, a business strategy, whatever you want to call it, you will have some idea of where you want that business to go. The marketing element of that is right, and how do you do that? How do you make the money, as in how do you currently do it, how have you done it in the past, and how are you going to do it in the future? And then to connect the dots to,
where's there an opportunity to change it, where's there an opportunity for growth, where's an opportunity to build more strength.
That requires that you understand the sales process, the sales cycle. Point one. Point two, that it is a repeatable process. And what I find with some small businesses is that the reason why they're still small is because they don't have a repeatable sales cycle more often than not. So therefore, they are in the discovery mode. They are trying to discover that sales process. They don't already have it. And if you haven't discovered it, you can't scale it. And if you haven't discovered it, my view is that every dollar you spend on sales, marketing, everything is in the effort of finding that process, not to really scale it. So therefore, you have to know that if you're in discovery mode, all of your dollars could be for naught. It's like debugging. You haven't found it until you found it. There is no deadline. There is no like expectation that by Thursday you will have this. And some companies get luckier, some are smarter. For whatever reason, they find that repeatable sales cycle. And now you're in scale mode, and then you can go have a great time. And now you can have more demands of marketing. But if you don't know the sales cycle, and I can't tell you how many companies I work with who do not have a repeatable sales cycle.
It might be interesting to throw another topic on the table with all of this when we talk about, you know, strengths and weaknesses in small business. What if we talked about data as part of marketing? And I could introduce that with our cartoon number two, if you will, which Shaheen discovered from Dilbert. I think we all know Dilbert. And he's standing in front of a group saying, "I didn't have any accurate numbers, so I just made this one up." And the number on the board is $4,629,873. And he says, "Studies have shown that our accurate numbers aren't any more useful than ones you make up." To which somebody says, "Well, how many studies showed that?" And he says, 87. So, but I think it, you know, it gets to this question of what do you do when you don't have data?
Recognizing that data is an ingredient, it's not the cake. And I think a lot of smaller businesses get it in their heads that if you have the data, the problem is solved. We just need more data. And actually, they are right. They do need more data, but it's just the data they're collecting is usually digital. It becomes a byword for Google Analytics, SEO data, e-commerce, Facebook likes. But what they're not doing is connecting those things, or necessarily even collecting the right things. As Shaheen was saying, you know, you've got to have an understanding of the sales cycle. Even if those sales look different over time, there's variance, you should have a rough idea of what it looks like for the average customer, at least the ones you want. And for me, that's an important part of the process. Like working with smaller businesses is that humility side of things, which is they've got to be humble enough to turn around to me and say, "I've not really been collecting data." And that's great, because when you start from that, you go, right, well, the first thing we need to do is, if we're a brand new startup or brand new business, that, because there isn't anything to go from, you've got to muddle through. But what you do is you go, well, we want to get to that point. So we'll start collecting the data that we really need. And some of it might not be useful. It might actually turn out to be junk. But ultimately, you've got to start collecting this stuff and trying to see how those variables have impact on ultimately, you know, getting a customer through the door. You know, if we post on Facebook, are we going to get more customers? Can we actually see that? Maybe you can, but don't just think that because you're getting more likes or more followers that it means anything.
I guess that's the question then, in a sense of like, you know, there's no way that a small business doesn't have incomplete data. And yet I've found most small businesses want to believe that they have data that gives them absolute answers. Like, oh, the data says spend this much more on Facebook and we'll get that many more leads, or, you know, whatever it is. What are the ways to work with incomplete data at that time?
I think with incomplete data, I think it's about being honest in those discussions and saying, well, data doesn't tell us anything. Data is like the comic shows. It's an illustration, essentially. This data can be interpreted in this way. Mm-hmm. And you can bend and twist data to suit a narrative that you're trying to tell anyway. Mm-hmm. And for me, data should be directional. That's its purpose, is to show some kind of trajectory, whether it's up or down overall. Mm-hmm. Is this good or is this bad? And how does it affect other things that we're doing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, a good example of this and why it's important to connect these dots is that if you have a really successful marketing campaign, let's say you put out a campaign and it just kicks off, it goes viral, everyone's sharing, everyone's talking about it. If you're a manufacturer and you don't have the capacity to meet customer demand, mm-hmm. you've screwed yourself. And that's why it's important to understand how these things connect, which is, well, if we get the demand, can we meet that demand? Or maybe we need to change our pricing to kind of taper demand, but still make the same profit. Again, as Doug said before, which is, you know, data actually kind of, you get more questions out of it than you do answers. You're not necessarily looking for answers. You're looking for a bit more clarity around what questions need to be asked. Mm-hmm. Because without any data, it's, I don't know, as both a question and an answer.
So my take is that everything is data and everybody has data. The question, like you're all saying, is to what extent can you use it? So my advice to small companies is to recognize the cost of building up this whole effort for instrumentation and analytics and the reporting. I think if you get something off of the dashboard of whatever tool that you're using for, that's great, use that. But recognize what it is actually measuring mm-hmm. and what it isn't measuring. And if you want to go beyond that, and if you have to spend money actually building a whole analytics thing, that money is coming out of doing actual marketing. And if you're a small business, you probably can't afford it. You probably would rather go to a small event than to go instrument the previous event. You know what I mean?
You have to keep in mind when you do that, that what you have is incomplete, right? And I think, you know, my sense is data can reveal at best data, and I mean a lot of data, at best reveals maybe half of the world you're involved with. Can mostly it's 20% or far less. And so you have to remember that all data is limited. And maybe we go back to that quote that about models, all data is limited, some data is useful. You know, that they're both true, you know, that all right. data has limits. So if you remember the limits and work within the limits of what you have, then you can maybe find other data that might, you know, make that data more useful, but you're looking for those really cost-effective ways to do it. I do think that businesses are encouraged to build large digital repositories of data, and, you know, that they convert, instead of everything being data comes to mean only that stuff that's digitally collected. And that is somehow inherently good because it's digital. And that's a misnomer. Some digital data is extraordinary. Some isn't. It depends.
And not all of your data is digital. But I feel like if you're a $500 million company, by all means, go mm-hmm. have a repository of data. Mm-hmm. You're big enough now and have enough money and you have enough resources to go really start taking advantage of the data that you have. Mm-hmm. But even then, you need to know about everything that, you know, I've written about, inaccuracy, incompleteness, irreproducibility, you know, all the other bugs that come with the data. And if you recognize that, then you can actually use it directionally, like Sam, you were saying. you know, establish a baseline, work to improve things, but now you have enough of a flywheel that you know statistically what works or what doesn't. That's the other problem with small companies, that you don't have enough of the statistics, right? If you have a total of 100 customers ever, okay, is that statistically significant? Well, it is if like 98 of them had the same sales process behind them. Mm-hmm. You know it's really repeatable. But if one deal came because you knew someone and the other deal came because of something else and there's really no pattern, then it becomes way harder, right?
Well, and I think too, it maybe is important to acknowledge that there are a fair number of businesses that are not based on statistically reliable quantities of customers. You know, my agency, we would have 3 to 4 big projects a year. You know, I can't get into predictions on that. I was talking to, actually, there's a guy next door that does project management. They do building build outs and stuff like this, and they're the same size. They're doing 3 or 4 major build outs a year. They lose one, and it's a huge effect on their business. But that's not a statistically manageable company in the sense that you can say, well, let's predict out 3 years worth of what's going to happen, because the accident of company A calling you is accident. You know, you can't control it. You can't predict it. You have to be ready. And that's a very different kind of management than something where, you know, maybe you have, you know, 100,000 customers or something. I remember, Shaheen, when Floating Point Systems went away and it moved to Sun, and some of the, I ran into one of the salespeople I'd worked with, and he was now at Sun, and he said, wow, it was really different. He said, you know, it felt like at Floating Point, we were like test pilots, you know, dealing with very specialized customers. And once you hooked one, you worked for a long time to get it closed. And that was very meaningful. Whereas at Sun, he had to sell 1 million units a year or whatever it was, 10,000 units a year. And that's a very different challenge. And I think sometimes that first type, the type of company that is very different, is not based on quantity, but based on small numbers, is almost an easier and a harder marketing challenge because it's very different. But most people talk about the large statistically valid ways of handling sales. I don't know if that makes any sense. Does that make sense?
Well, I think that if I understand properly, I think the smaller ones require more of an in-depth conversation because a lot of data is not digital. Sam, you were about to say?
I was just going to say that makes total sense. That mirrors my experiences, Doug. In that, you know, you're not looking at statistically valid information because it's not that game. That's not the game you're playing. And it's and also when it's service related, that is often how it is. You know, B2B, and this is the argument when people try, I disagree with it. People say, well, B2B marketing is different. Well, not really, but actually in some ways, yes. And that's a prime example. But with data, you can still get data from that, but it's just small data with a lowercase s. You know, it's qualitative. It's going, well, why did they choose us? Mm-hmm. Why did they enter the category? It's questions like that. And I've done research before where we've made good, informed, strategic decisions by interviewing 5 people. And that's because they had 15 customers a year. So whilst it's not statistically valid, I guess, but it's still, you know, a third of the customer base that we talked to. And we still learned a lot of things there. We look for those common themes as to what was driving those purchase decisions. And then we could use that information because if we didn't ask those questions, we weren't going to know that stuff ultimately.
I also want to add the importance of insight and experience. Mm-hmm. Because if I talk to someone who's experienced, it may be one person. And if the answer is valid, it doesn't have to be statistically valid. Right. It's already valid. And if I'm talking to someone who has like 20 years, 25 years, whatever worth years of experience, I'm getting the sum total of all the data that this person absorbed over their careers. So I'm really getting the essence of a lot of data and the interpretation of someone who's experienced enough to interpret it properly. So that's highly valuable, even though it is one source.
Well, and I think too, it you know, we somehow sometimes value groupthink over individual think. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in the focus group work that we would do, we might do, instead of 4 focus groups, we talked to 32 people across 2 cities. And I can remember a number of projects where one individual's comment stands out because you realize that they grasped and summarized kind of the whole sense of what we had heard. You know, it's not that they stand out because they're more important than others, but because that comment brought together all these threads we had heard that were consistent with the other two, but they're the ones that do it. I mean, one was on home security, and I remember clearly this sense in LA of this guy basically, the key in home security is we want a system so good that the crook can't even get on our property. And that really summarized a lot of what we had heard. It also is impossible. So, you know, that was a really important breakthrough to notice that what they really want is not possible. So we're always dealing with partial solutions to it. And, you know, that can lead you somewhere. And groupthink tends to soften all that. And we lose sometimes in a groupthink. Like if you say, well, instead of trusting one really experienced person, we're going to go trust, you know, we're going to go get the sense of 15 less experienced people. You might do better that way. You might not. There's nothing inherently that says that 10 or 15 partially experienced people is going to get you anything.
Or you're going to get no AI avatars.
Yeah, that's true.
It's coming too. So let's bring it home. One thing that we discussed pre-call was some of the articles that, Sam, you've written that we wanted to double-click on. Do you guys want to tee that up?
Yeah, I mean, the first one that struck me was Sam wrote one called, "Can I Have Your Attention, Please?" And he notes that the first thing to recognize, and this is quoting, is that attention itself is not an end goal. It's an important step towards sales, but attention is not enough to make money. To impact sales, attention needs to build mental associations that establish your brand, product, or service in the minds of your potential customers. And I think in the world of communication and advertising, that is such a critical truth, because I know even in business school, a lot of students would come into my advertising classes. I'd say, "What's the purpose of advertising?" And the answer was, "Build awareness." I'm like, "No." You know, because maybe you need to get people to understand what you have.
It may be the reality of advertising. It's not its purpose.
So I guess a very long piece in summary, it's essentially saying attention should be appropriate. And by appropriate, it's make it associative. It has to tie into the product or service or brand. However, it's easier said than done. Because in practice, what we see in advertising communications is the desire to get attention at all costs. You see big brands do it. You see small brands do it because people think any attention is good attention. And that's just evidently not true. So the point that me and Max were trying to make, and Max himself has done a lot of research into category entry points and all these things. He's worked with big brands. He has tons of experience on this stuff. So having him involved in this article was really key to kind of make it solid. Rather than just a theory piece, we wanted to make it something really solid. So we wanted to just make it really clear to people that don't just make stuff that's got explosions in it unless those explosions are relevant.
I was going to say, it's interesting because I think I've detected in the ad business, there's like this belief that it's impossible to get people to pay attention. And I don't find that true. It's like what I've found is if you have something that matters, people are alert to it. If you have a product that solves a problem for them, that'll get their attention. And I think that sometimes, I mean, maybe it's this tendency we have to try to simplify things to one most important thing. And in advertising will get simplified to, well, if you don't get their attention, it's no good. Therefore, we have to have, you know, explosions, people jumping, all this stuff that maybe that's not the key. Maybe, in fact, you're in a situation where people will pay attention merely because you say, well, I work for E.F. Hutton, and E.F. Hutton says, to remember an old ad from the 70s where everybody in the restaurant then turns their head and pays attention. You know, there are times when we can say, you know, we can, you know, say some quiet things and people will instantly pay attention.
Well, it's the AIDA without the EDA.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a case of feeling, it feels a bit like Adland is full of embarrassed artists who, you know, want to be artists. That's what they want to do. That's really what they want to do. And the creative ideas are so out there sometimes that they just don't really make sense. I mean, you look at it in terms of the chatter in Adland, particularly about what's successful versus what is actually successful. They're worlds apart. And that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for Adland. It's not a good thing for businesses. And it actually makes everyone look a bit silly. There's a current ad at the minute, which I absolutely detest. and it's a KFC one. It says Believe in Chicken, and it's just a giant chicken dancing a bit. And I'm like, well, maybe that gets attention, but there's no relevance there to category entry points, period. It doesn't tell me anything. It doesn't tell me why I should buy it. It doesn't communicate where, like, it doesn't communicate anything of value to me as a potential customer. And Burger King tried to do that with their Moldy Whopper ad to try and make the point of, you know, we don't put preservatives in it. But again, it's, I get where they're going with that, but it's like shock value that doesn't quite hit the mark in terms of what's appropriate, which is, well, people are walking around. They're not going to stop and stare at that ad. View it in context, you know, view it from the customer's point of view. So ultimately that's the point we wanted to make in that article, which is brands, businesses of any size, small, large, whatever, need to really understand customers first and what drives their purchase behavior, and category wide as well, what drives those behaviors. And then you can start to create communications that are attention grabbing, but actually do hit the mark in terms of what the ads are supposed to do, which is, you know, sell stuff ultimately.
Excellent. And then there was another article that we also talked about. Let's do that a couple of minutes too.
Yeah, Sam has a second article he had called Brand, Making the Intangible Tangible. And I just pulled a little tiny bit. I mean, it's a really good, useful article. But I pulled this one bit out that says, for a business to succeed in brand management, it must accept that there are things simply too murky to fully understand or manage. There will always be gaps in information. It must embrace its known unknowns. Being aware of limitations and asking hard questions anyway is required. This is how a brand begins to understand itself, through continuous exploration and discovery. And I couldn't agree more.
Well said. That. Yeah.
I recently wrote something, Sam, where I suggested that to understand things like brand, we got to think about it a bit like a painter in a landscape, that a painter moves 10 feet and that landscape changes. And so, you know, what a painter would do is move around to understand the whole of the landscape, because it's not something we can grasp in a single glance and really understand. And maybe that applies here too, that to really grok your brand, you need to have many different views into it.
You know, the intelligence services being actively involved, and some, these people are some of the smartest people in the world. If they can't predict the outcomes of these things, then what hope do brands and businesses have? Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, they're big, but they're not military budget big. They don't have that level of, you know, logistical perfection, you know? So for me, it's just give yourself a break.
One of the things that makes, you know, large companies sometimes uncomfortable with the idea of small company marketing is that the uncertainty in small company marketing cannot be ignored. On the other hand, once you get into a big enough company, you can kind of ignore the uncertainty. As Shaheen noted, well, you're going to get a certain amount of revenue by the end of the quarter. But that also means you're ignoring the key uncertainties in your business that you have to grasp to succeed. Yeah.
No Camo, you know, they do really good work that's quite high level. They're really impressive. They're really smart. So to be challenged like that was really difficult for me. And I really had to put pen to paper and think, okay, just what am I being asked here? And I'm really glad that it turned out the way it did, because it was difficult to write. But I always feel like I write better than I can talk, which is why I like writing. So I think, again, I wanted it to be a piece that kind of challenges not only marketers, but other people in the business, which is to recognize that brand is this kind of ethereal, wishy-washy word. And that is how it is, unfortunately. And that is the challenge of brand management. You know, it's not as simple as, you know, how do you measure it? It's like, well, it's not really a measurement. It's more like an asset, but it's a floaty, weird asset that's in gas form that floats around everything and you can't really see it, but it's definitely there, because if it wasn't there, then everything would be priced at a utilitarian price point, wouldn't it? It would be the sum of it, everything would just be made at cost and sold at cost. There would be no such thing as profit. There would be no such thing as margins, because, you know, brand and the strength of brand goes, it's not just in the eye of the customer. It goes through the whole supply chain. It goes through everything, you know, like bigger businesses get better business loan terms because they're bigger and people can think they can trust them more. That may not be entirely true, but people assume it. Going back to that business loan point you were making, Doug, you know, like they like to give money to bigger businesses because they think they're safe. They're not necessarily more safe at all. There's no certainty there, but they like to think that there is. And part of that is to do with, you know, brand. It's that kind of all-encompassing word that means nothing, but also means everything. And that's the challenge of it.
All right. Great conversation. We should do this again, like we said last time. And last time we did it, so maybe we'll do it this time too. Any kind of final comments before we conclude this episode? Doug, you go first.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up, you know, we don't need to talk about it, but we did have a brief discussion before about one of the challenges for small businesses is we really lack books. A lot of times I think publishers decide that if it's about small business that they get the business equivalent of toddler board books when you talk to small businesses, you know, like Be Very Hungry Small Brand or, you know, whatever that your favorite board book would be. I will say I did find one book that I really liked by a guy named Bo Burlingham, and it's called Small Giants, Small Business and Growth. And he looks at the question of whether companies have to grow. And in particular, points out that 99% of companies in the U.S. are not public. And yet all the advice we get is for companies that are public. And then what they do is they dumb it down for small businesses. Instead, he looks at a set of businesses that chose to stay small. And it's really interesting. It's a good read. I recommend it. Again, Bo Burlingham, Small Giants, Small Business
Growth. Good find,
growth.
Yeah. Sam, last word?
Yeah, in terms of books, actually, I am reading something at the minute, which is not actually a marketing book, but is a great insight into how something weird and small grew into something huge. And it's called Talking Miniatures, and it's about the history of Warhammer and Games Workshop. So for anyone who doesn't know, Games Workshop, aka Warhammer, make tiny little 28mm plastic figures, and they're worth billions of pounds. They are absolutely huge. They're a global business. It's a hobby like D&D. People are maybe more familiar with that. It's the same thing. It's nerdy stuff. And this book is all about the staff and the inner machinations of what it was like in those early days. It's not written to boast. It's just an insight into the journey and lots of interviews with people who used to work there, who don't work there anymore, people who have set up their own companies. And it's not only a love letter to the past and how great it was and crazy and creative, but it's also a really good insight, I think, for business people to look at and go, wow, that doesn't seem like it makes any sense. But actually, it all came together in the end. And I think for smaller businesses, that is the reality. It's quite chaotic and weird. And I think given the nature of it, which is it is about, you know, fantasy and plastic soldiers and started in Hammersmith in London with a single shop and was all over the place, I think it's a really fascinating read. And again, because it's got that those interviews with people, it really gives you a more human perspective. It's not just analyzing business numbers and how you can be like them. So I definitely recommend having a look at that. And also, again, I think to my final comment is that small businesses, yes, it's really hard. And yes, it's scary, but you have to just go with that. You have to accept that's how it is. You know, good marketing is not about chasing this perfect idea. You need to move away from looking for predictability. You need to look for, why do people buy? How are we selling what we're selling now? Why are we successful now? And really asking tons and tons of questions about where you are now. Questions that often aren't asked in the day-to-day because people think, you know, well, they just take it for granted. And I think that that kind of outside view of the business separated from you is really important. And, you know, all businesses do marketing, whether they call it marketing or not is a different thing. But if you do understand what marketing is, you can definitely structure it better for growing an organization.
Right on. That's really important. Also, what you said, that everybody does marketing, whether or not they have a marketing department. That's so true. Yeah. Well, excellent. Thank you. Any other comments before we wrap?
No, just that I have a new book on my list.
All right. All right. Thank you, everybody, for being with us. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Doug.
Until next time.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Take care.
That's it for this episode of the Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.